This is the final channel session for today. So if you've been in this room more than once, you consider yourself a channel nerd. We're all channel nerds. No, actually, I was just having a conversation about what it's like to work in the channel and some of the years many of you put into this. And sometimes people come into this organization, the channel organization, from different walks of life, whether it's sales or marketing, and dealing with partners is really difficult. One of the things that we know about partners is that they don't work for us, right? So it is a job to capture their attention. And what we're going to talk about today is just that, is what does it take to capture a partner's attention and really engage them, not just in marketing, but in just about anything that you want to do. And so I welcome you to our panel today on the state of partner engagement. And I'd like to introduce you to our panelists. First, I'll say that I've had a wonderful experience working with all of these folks, and I appreciate you guys taking some time out in this conference to be on the hot seat, so to speak. Jamie, I hope I spelled your name right, but that's Jamie Mendez. Okay. Jamie runs channel marketing at IBM. And as you all know, IBM has an incredible channel program for many years. And a typical IBM partner probably has about 6 or 7 other relationships with other suppliers. And so there's this mind share that they're constantly dealing with. And Jamie's going to share some of the things that she sees as challenges and some of the things that she could overcome at IBM. We also have David Portnowitz. And David is the chief marketing officer at Star to Star. And he has an awesome podcast. If you haven't heard it, just have to figure out what's your favorite type of sandwich when you do it. But David's in a unique position because I think his organization sees having the benefits and the programs that you all deliver as a competitive differentiator for his company. And it's not just about mindshare for him. It's about eclipsing that towards higher performance and recruiting the right partners and, you know, attracting them to the company. So David's going to share some of the things that they're doing over at Star to Star, which after all, they work with a lot of MSPs, which is very competitive, right? And then finally, we have Jason Statham over here. And Jason...
Jeez. I'm bold.
Actually, I just really think he looks like Jason Statham. But, you know, Cameron Avery, ex-CEO for Elastic Grid and a fellow Zifter, has a unique perspective, because I remember Cameron working years ago with you, and you had the grid, the Elastic Grid. And for some of you who've been in high-tech channels, you remember partners really liked that. They really used it, and some of the suppliers that they work with will say, you know, the user, the interface, everything just kind of came together. And so we're going to have Jason over here talk a little bit about... what it takes from a technology platform standpoint, right? So before we do that, I just want to talk to you a little bit about the questions and the types of issues that we'll tackle, and then I'll give you a feel for the current state. So I'm going to try and tackle that first one around the current state of engagement and channels. So again, we're going to talk about challenges, who's winning, who's losing, and also talk a little bit about some of the best practices. So what do we hear? And it should be no surprise to you that partner engagement is a difficult thing, whether it's taking that platform-first approach that many suppliers do, you know, build it and they will come, or just really the big divide that exists between those partners that you rely on for revenue that generally engage and those partners that don't, that are a constant struggle to just get them to do anything inside your program. We all realize that if you don't have partners active in your program, you don't have pipeline, you don't have opportunities. It all starts there. And that's why this is such a big issue. It really plagues a lot of channel programs. And so engagement is one of those things that nobody really owns, but everyone is responsible for. And so what we see is this great divide. And I'm going to show you some stats here, which are pretty interesting. We took some of the top 10 suppliers on our platform and sort of what their average engagement is. Now, again, remember, I work for Zip Solutions. We have a platform that our partners use. It's irrespective of this conversation. But I wanted to show you some of the percentage engagement, and some of them are high, right? 70-something percent on average working with partners all the time getting engaged like that. But let me bring a more sobering note. And by the way, when I talk about engagement, you can see on the right-hand side here, I kind of laid out, it's not just clicking and downloading stuff. It's really engaging on your platform, right? But let me show you what the industry average is. 11 to 15%. Now, there's a lot of folks at this conference that will validate that. And if you look at your channel program, on average, the larger population, how many people actually get involved, you might align yourself to those numbers. So what's the difference? What's the difference between the industry average and some of the folks that could really make an impactful results in your program? And so we're going to turn to our panelists to try to understand this broad divide that exists in most channel programs. And I'll just basically start with, you know, what's the state of partner engagement in your program? And David, I know you're all over your partners all the time trying to do this the right way. How would you characterize the way partners engage in your program?
I would say that for us, partner engagement and partner mindshare is number one. So we start there. I would say before we started working with Zift, I would say our numbers were somewhere in that 10 to 15% range. When we got involved with Zift and we sort of started that process, we pushed that number up towards 40 to 45%. And we feel like that's a great number for our partners need to be. But it wasn't because of the platform, right? It was because we started doing proactive outbound reach to our partners to try to tell them about the benefits that we had. We view the marketing department at Star to Star as sort of an agency for the partners. We take it to them as this is a full service creative digital agency that has everything that you need to help sell sell any product that you're selling. Obviously, we want them to sell Star to Star, and those are the things that we'll create for them. But if they need help in other just general sales areas, we'll provide that support as well. We want to be seen as an asset to the partner. And that's how we think we're going to increase engagement overall. If we can sort of become a trusted advisor to them, if we can provide them with free services, then we think that is the way to get really to their heart and to their mind.
Can marketing do it alone?
We can try. No, we need sales. I mean, that from our standpoint, we rely on our sales team pretty heavily, but we also equip them with the right materials. So we're providing them with the right assets, the right statistics, the right nomenclature, everything we want them to talk about with the partners, especially with new partners. So as we onboard new partners, that's really where we feel like we can make a difference, because, you know, with existing partners, sometimes they're stuck in their ways. They may not want to change. They have a system that works. They could be stubborn, right? They're stuck in their old ways. With new partners, we feel like we can sort of start them fresh, get them in the system, teach them, sort of train them on how we want them to interact with us. And we feel that is really the ideal setting for us.
Okay. So that's one side of the story. At IBM, with Watson and Cloud and, you know, a slew of products that you're coming at them with, how do you bank on partners actually using the things that you offer them in the program at IBM, Jamie?
Okay, so this is complex because we, as Laz is kind of pointing out, we have a broad portfolio. We have 80,000 partners in around the globe in 192 countries, or 172 countries, I should say. And we're never going to get it right. You cannot mathematically target the partner to get them the right content at the right time for the right purpose. So we have to use tools like Watson to identify what that partner needs. And it's all about intimacy at scale, right? They need to be able to count on us reaching out to them at the right moment with the right information, with the right program, to get involved and to have something that converts into business. So we don't look just at engagement rates. In fact, we're kind of trying to build this essence of there's no daylight between marketing and selling, that it's a one unit. Everybody marches, works in unison together, and you start at the beginning and you move through the whole process together. Not that sales gets involved in filling the pipeline or getting partners engaged. That's marketing's job. But sales needs to be a wholly bought in stakeholder in that process. And then as we're handing over to sales, it is a warm handover. We don't make assumptions about, hey, you knew we were running the program. We're throwing it over the fence at you. Everybody has to play a role all the way through the journey. And that's hard to do at scale. So that's why you have to use AI to figure out what does that journey look like? And what are all the permutations of that? And what are the triggers that allow Watson to know, in our case, Watson, some of you have other things, but for Watson to know what you need at that time. And it's only through repetition and failure and success that Watson learns what you need. So we're not at perfection yet. We're still learning ourselves and teaching Watson, but with every engagement, Watson gets smarter and smarter about what our partners need and is able to serve up the right content, right program, right recommendation for the partner at that time. So AI is a big part.
So you hear sales alignment is critically important. Having data on your partners so that you know what you're asking and who you're asking to do certain things is really important. Maybe some of you don't have that data, and it'd be interesting to see how some of the smaller programs might deal with this. But let's say you have picked the right partner and you've got sales on board. And Cameron, they come to a platform. What's going to make them do something on that platform? What's in it for them?
Exactly that. Can you hear me?
Yeah.
Sorry, it's the accent. When they come to the platform, the WIFM is like, what's in it for them? They've literally got to be greeted at the front door. You've got to let them know what the value is for the program they're about to enter into. And you've got to entice them in. I know IBM, Star2Star, but these partners are out there. They've got multiple programs and vendors coming at them. You've really got to now entice them and bring them into the environment. So you've got to address that right from the get-go. And then when you get them into the platform, I think the most important thing is, I think Dave Lewis touched on it yesterday, and I think he did hashtag frictionless, and I thought that was genius because it's just got to be easy. It's like that you've got to know that they're a partner, that they're a salesperson, and now you've actually taken them into an environment that knows that, and perhaps not using Watson, which is genius and something that IBM's created, but you've actually got to, in that portal, serve up what they want when they want it as best you can. And I think, so it all comes down to being frictionless and the partner experience, so PX, and actually welcoming them in and don't get them confused. Just take them to, a couple of swim lanes that they're in sales, get them to dual registration or, into a sales enablement toolkit and don't get them lost in your environment. I think that's really important.
All right, so you got to be conscious about that partner's journey and answer questions. And they're not all going to be the same type of person. So you got to answer questions for the persona and the partner. So data, alignment, and journey, the partner experience are all going to be important. So the state of the channel kind of shows us that there are companies making steps in the right direction, right? But there are inherent perils in this journey, right? And one of them is the competitiveness. This partner wants to work with that supplier wants to work with that partner, and before you know it, four or five different suppliers are knocking on their door. David, in a world that consists of these small managed service providers where, it's every man for himself or every woman for herself, how do you penetrate that? How do you know? What are those challenges that you're seeing these guys that are unique that maybe you didn't see before?
So I think the easy answer is money. So I think, that's in our space where, the next promotion is richer than the last promotion is, everybody is sort of one-upping each other. That can only go so far, right? I mean, it commoditizes it, kills your bottom line. It really makes it impossible to do business. So, we view an MSP or we take a look at a VAR, an interconnect, an agent, an MSP, whatever the case is. And we try to stay top of mind by being, like you said, it sort of trying to understand when they want the content, but how do we deliver the content to them that's going to be easy to use? And so you have to walk them through it. I mean, we have to be concierge level marketing services. Otherwise, they're not going to do it. I mean, we have tried. We
you know, we tried a hands-off approach and we gave them all the materials and we said, go at it, like build it and they will come. You know, did they come? No. I mean, they didn't. So I think the only way you can really do it, unless you maybe have Watson, I don't have Watson. Can you give me Watson? I just kind of want.
There's a discount on Watson at the end of this.
So I, you know, for us, it's really trying to handhold them. And we do everything from, you know, an initial call to walking through what's in the portal, showing them how to execute the campaign, showing them how, what results they're going to get, staying top of mind, right at the, you know, telling them here's a new promotion that's available that you can execute on your own website. Really, really, really trying to push at the right times. You know, you don't want to be too frequent because it's going to drive them crazy, but you also don't want to go away because it, like you said, the competitive nature is that someone else is going to gobble them up. So, you know, there is no magic bullet. I wish there was, but for us, what's been the key is to be, is to look at our experience as a concierge, as a VIP level experience for the partners, where they feel like they're special, where they feel like, you know, we are hand holding him. We are really, 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 a resource they can rely on for anything, even if it's not marketing related or sales related, or if it's, they got a tech support issue, that, you know, whatever the case is, they feel like they can come to marketing first. And that's kind of how we have differentiated ourselves in that space.
That's awesome. How many of you are using concierge services or giving this kind of white glove treatment to their partners? Yeah. So about half of you, and you see the results, right? You see some of the stickiness, some of the partners engaging. Cameron, how do you do this in multiple languages?
Very, very difficult. I think, and also Japan is just, I don't know, has anybody got teams in Japan? But is it run in Japan by Japanese, and don't you try and force anything into that market? So that's a tough market. Germany was pretty difficult, but with GDPR, I think it's gotten a lot easier. But look, to be successful in language is not going to be, this is not going to be the answer you want to hear, because it's expensive. You've got to have people in country, in language, you know, talking to those partners. If you do that, you will see a great return on investment. But I really do get that that can be quite expensive. So you could go down to just, you know, the text window, that's now the chat bot that's given, but it's got to be in language. That's a cheaper alternative. Or you've got to have a fantastic online university about your program and how to use it in language. But definitely concierge support, you can do it reasonably around the world. There's places like Romania, they have pretty fantastic hubs there where you can hire people that really are born in Germany, born Italy, French, and you can build out a team there very successfully to support your program. But and then having that concierge support one click away from that partner tapping out of your platform. You want them to answer the question as soon as possible, you know, and follow the sun around the world if you can, if you have the budget to do so.
Good advice. And I know you've had a lot of experience doing that. So let's stay on the global track, Jamie. You have regional teams, you have regional partners, and you're trying to coordinate this in a company with such a huge channel program. You know, what are some of the challenges for a global program that are unique at IBM rather than, say, something you'd see in a regional program?
Well, it goes back to one size doesn't fit all, right? If you create a global program and then you go to deploy in far corners of the planet, it's got to be modified for whatever reason. There's localization issues, whether it's, you know, geopolitical, you know, regulatory, you know, business practice. You're going to have to make modifications, and you need to build the flexibility in your framework to allow for that. You know, there's some things that you're going to hold sacred, like your brand. You're not going to sacrifice your brand, you know, in the Caribbean because they like better colors than what you've created here in the US. But, you know, there are other things that aren't going to affect your, you know, staying power or your growth in the marketplace. So those are some of the, you know, having that conversation about what's in the guardrails for localization is really important right up front, you know, as you're kicking out your campaigns and you're having those conversations. If I may, I just want to go back to the conversation that, that we were having here about, you know, what does it take and how are you going to, you know, how do you kind of get partners to engage? I can't help but always at these kind of things want to bring my crystal ball out and Jamie's predictions of things, but to get you to just be, I like to be provocative. That's just my personality. But just think about where we're at in the channel right now. And the fact that we have some bifurcation going on. I mean, we were talking when we first came in about all the mergers and acquisitions that are going on. And, you know, you start betting on one partner and guess what? Tomorrow they're gone because they just got eaten up by another partner. Or, you know, you had a partner that you knew was an ISV. And what is an ISV today? Because now they're out providing services around the IP that they've developed, right? If you, it looks like everybody in here was in the consumer bit as a consumer and had buying power in 2008. Remember what happened in 2008? We had a market crash. And what happened? We had a lot of people who didn't have a whole lot of money. And out of that was born things like Uber. People couldn't buy cars. So they were willing to pay for a ride for the amount of time they needed it. What else happened? Airbnb can't afford an apartment. You know, I'll pay for a mattress in somebody's room. I bring that up because I think one of the things that we as channel marketers have to think about is what is this consolidation and the potential for recession and consolidation continuing going to do to how we behave as marketers? And what I would posit here is think about some of your partners as your marketing arm, because what we're seeing is that there are partners with really good marketing skills, and then there's some with none, right? None whatsoever. But when you bring those partners together to work together, guess what? They don't have to spend money, and they're taking your product forward. They're taking your initiative forward, and they're doing it together as a partnership. They both have skin in the game. So what we're investing in is bringing those partners together, in building these teams to go after the market together. And they both have skin in the game and they both go after. And that makes it a little bit easier to manage through these consolidation periods and to do kind of this scale and geography spread that we have to, because we know that they have a stake in each other and they're not going to go away.
Is this co-opetition or collaboration?
Both. It depends on how you decide to build your teams.
Okay.
Co-opetition is a whole lot harder to make happen, but it's magic when it does. The complementary collaboration is much easier to do, but you have to know who your rock stars are for marketing and client reach. Because at the end of the day, it's about who's in the clients, and they're the conduit, the channel, for other partners in your ecosystem to move into that client. So just think about it as a marketing strategy for the channel that gives you some alternatives and some flex power.
How many of you are selling cloud solutions? Okay. I think that's incredible advice for a solution that sometimes is comprised of multiple vendors, right? How do you pull that together? So that's good words there. So you said something that was pretty interesting. These guys are having a conversation on their own.
Sorry.
Why don't we just play a little music in the back and just let it go, right? you said something that's just kind of lit a bulb in my head, which was, we all know the 80-20s, right? The 80-20 rule. Is it me or is it getting worse, right? Because I used to call it the 80-20 rule. And then somebody would always make that remark, well, we're more like the 90-10, right? So I don't see it getting better. Nobody's talking about the 70-30 rule, right? And you just said that there are these performers, and then there's these guys that just don't have the resources, the know-it-all, the wherewithal, let alone the skills. What makes that good partner?
You mean the guys, the market reach guys? Because the other guys are great partners too. They have IP. They have capabilities and skills that you need to be successful. So I don't want to at all color that as a non-productive partner. They have a role. But what makes a good marketing partner? I would say it's customer reach and knowledge, right? And if they know their customers and they have the reach, they have the marketing engine typically. And when I say engine, I mean people processes. They may need money and help from all of you vendors, right? That have all of the marketing vendors that are in the room to make that come to life. They're probably not doing it themselves. I mean, I think IBM has a great marketing machine. We don't do it by ourselves. We can't. We couldn't possibly do everything that we need to do. And we hire and partner to do that. So, but the right I think that the beautiful partners are the ones, and successful partners are the partners who know their customers. They're not trying to go out and get everybody on the edge. They're not playing around the edge. They know their customers, they know their routes, they know their strategy, and they know how to get into them and what vendors they need to partner with.
Yeah, I would agree. I was going to say, for us, the partners that are successful are the ones that know their verticals, right? So we have lots of partners that are really good in healthcare, or really good in finance, or really good in legal, and we try to create the campaigns or whatever the case is that's going to give them those tools to succeed. You know, we have, when a partner comes to us and doesn't know who their customer is or how to even attract a customer, or maybe they're a one or two person shop, you know, that can be a struggle. And that's not the, you know, for us, you know, that's not the right partner for us in some situations. So it's tough to turn it down, right? Because, you know, you have a partner coming, knocking on your door saying, look, I want to partner with you. I want to resell your product. You know, I want to do business with you. And you're like, that sounds great, but I've seen this happen over and over and over again. And we're going to invest in training you and sending sales engineer support with you and walking you through an installation and onboarding you and getting our people. I mean, just time and energy and resources. And then 6 months later, that partner is going to be gone. You're never going to hear from them again. You know, they did one sale. Maybe they came to you with an opportunity. They said, oh, your solution fits the opportunity I'm looking at really well. They come to you with an opportunity, they make that sale, and then they're gone. And that's not the kind of partner we want. I'm sure that's not the kind of partner you guys look for either. So, you know, is it an 80-20? Is it 90-10? I don't know. For us, you know, I look at our top 25, top 50 partners every year and try to see how much of that is new blood. And, you know, that's sort of how I gauge it, because you know, anything below 50, 100 partners. Now, we don't have 80,000 partners like you guys. So, but, you know, that's going to give me an indication of what's actually working and who's actually selling. You know, and I think, you know, it's okay to say no to a partner sometimes. And that can be really difficult, especially if a salesperson is commissioned on driving new partners, or, you know, they're commissioned on finding new partners or recruiting. But, you know, for us, we try to look at not finding new, not recruiting, but keeping the set number of partners in a contributing base and looking at who is, you know, that number may fluctuate. You may lose 5, but you may gain 7. So, you know, we just try to look at that number holistically and not try to freak out every single time there's an up and down swing.
So you guys are actively trying to get those partners more and more engaged. So you're looking at the ones that are constantly engaged.
Yeah, I mean, there's partners that have been with us since the inception of our company, and we know that they're going to keep selling because they're exclusive to us, and that's how they make their livelihood. So, I mean, they're not going to stop selling our product. But, you know, we're trying to recruit new ones, and we know we're going to lose some. You know, our partner retention is not a unique is not a unique problem to Star to Star or to IBM or whatever the case is. Partner retention isn't. I mean, it's the most impossible statistic to try to overcome. I mean, we just constantly are trying to find ways to stay in front of that partner. And it, you know, they're just like, you know, squirrels. They just keep moving from place to place. They see a shiny object here and then they're on to the next thing. So it's tough.
It's a full court press, no doubt. I want to revisit something that you said and see where the audience is, if anybody has any ideas on this. So I get it about adding partners to add pipeline and making sure that you've got that going on, right? Who adds partners to add pipeline, right? The recruitment numbers go up when you need some revenue. I get that. But you also said that your best partner, both of you said it, is a partner who knows their customers, right? And we don't want to teach them everything, but it sounds like we need to teach them some account-based marketing. And how does that work? If you can't even get them to use your platform, how can you get them to understand that, hey, there's this nuance in the way that we want to go to market? And my second question is, do suppliers even recognize this? Or are they just thinking of it as net new, right? So the first question, right? How do you get partners to adopt some of the more sophisticated things like account-based marketing? Is it training? Is it watch me do it and then try it on your own? Or do you just kind of put it off? And I open this to the audience too, if any of you are doing account-based marketing with your partners.
So again, because we have so many partners, we do have partners that do practice account-based marketing. I mean, we have, you know, $150, $200 million, you know, revenue partners. So these are, you know, they have their own marketing machines. They know what they're doing. And one of the best things that you can do is use them as a case study, right? To show the guys who don't do it what happens when you do it. So here's an example of someone who looks like you or you aspire to be. You want to be like them? Do the kinds of things that they do. And then when they say, I want to be like them, and you've done the case study, then you better be ready to follow through with, now let us give you an opportunity to learn, right? Because you can't hold them up and hold them accountable for behaving and practicing a certain way if you're not enabling them at the same time to do it. And it's, again, the thinking around it is you're not just enabling the marketer. You're not just enabling the salesperson. You've got to enable top to bottom. The top has to understand the strategy. The marketing and selling practitioners need to know how to execute. And the technical folks and the field folks need to know how to support. So we often go in with point actions, like I'm going to enable the salesperson. I'm going to have a conversation with the executive. But we are guilty, mostly OEM vendors. We're often guilty of just saying, oh, let's do a sales play. And, you know, it gets stuck. So just think, consistently think systems thinking. Have I covered everything in the whole process in whatever I'm executing?
And that includes process and everything else. I just wanted, there's one thing you said there that I don't want any of you to miss, right? And it was what you said about the case study of the partner, right? One of the most impactful things you can do at the early stage of working with a partner is to show them another partner who's succeeding in your program. Cisco's really great at this. You know, they put a lot of videos up. I think at one conference, they passed out their flip phones. And the next thing you know, anytime a partner had a success, they would record it. And within a week, it would be online. And now other partners could say, hey, I'm thinking of selling the Cisco XYZ product. But wait, there's a partner who sold it and the guy's talking about how great it was and you should do it too and so on. So that kind of reference is really, really important and I didn't want anybody to miss it because it is a great way to get partners that aren't on board or partners that aren't as active into your program, right? That's a real important one. David, did you want to add something to this? Because I saw you grab the mic. Okay. I've got a question for you, Cam. All right, so I buy into all of this. You got a partner to think about how do you market to your existing customers, right? The more that you know about them, the better chances you have of them taking you up on an offer. And then you have to ask the partner for the list. What happens?
Well, that's usually a concierge support kind of function. But actually, I want to address...
No, he doesn't want to answer my question.
No, I thought what David was talking about, and sorry, as a vendor, it's very important. Like you mentioned, look, I don't want to waste time. You're not wasting time, but I want to really focus in on partners that are actually drawing the most revenue. And I think whatever platform you're using to run your channel, I think a lot of the heavy lifting can be done in kind of swim lanes. You can say, okay, look, you want to be part of the program. You can push them into the portal and say, you know, you're a do-it-yourselfer and we've got enough of that type of functionality inside the portal so that you're going to be successful and it's going to be fairly hands-off. And then as you go and you start to recognize either through your onboarding process, sales, or whatever you're doing to monitor, you know, looking at your partner ecosystem, you can then decide whether it's going to be, you know, a do-it-with-me or a do-it-for-me. And I think some of the bigger partners, they're do-it-yourselfers. They will want campaigns to go and other things inside your portal that they can go and take. And then they could be those partners that you mentioned that are, you know, $200 million partners. They want your assets and they, you know, want other things from the portal and they're going to go away and put it into their marketing engine. So I think some of the heavy lifting can be done through your portal and can address the different types of partners that you have in your ecosystem without hopefully taxing some of your internal resources. Now,
so you got the partner to come to your portal and yep. He's a low touch partner. And you say, look, I've got a couple of plays here, the concierge, but it requires them to trust you and offer up the list. And that's really hard, right? You guys have trouble with partner data and getting their lists and using that in campaigns? Let's at least try.
It is difficult because a lot of your partners, the smaller ones especially, they don't actually have the list in the first place. So
I think the one key takeaway, if we're focusing in on partners and marketing globally, if you want the digital heavy lifters in any channel program, even if we looked at all the big data we have, you know, things like social syndication and content syndication, they're set and forget. So set and forget. They're three words partners love because they can get instant value, they can do it easily, and it's not going to tax them internally. And if you then want to go, you know, further, and they have uploaded their database, don't just give them an email, you know, nurture flow of three emails, no landing page or some PDF asset. And I know we're all more sophisticated than that now, but you certainly do want to develop a nurture track that's going to lead with thought leadership. Now, this might be controversial, but don't even put your logo on it. Say the five, whatever technology you're in, trends for 2019 that you need to know about, you know, in your small business, they will eat that up all day. They'll execute it. And then the tail end of that will be a pain point resolution of what your solution does. And of course, you're going to be the hero to the story. And at the end of that, you're then going to pump them into a validation track that, you know, your technology is the best and you can prove it because here's a fantastic case study. So I don't know whether that answered your question.
No, but it did confuse the heck out of a lot of people here. But that's
because they don't understand you,
actually,
Jason.
I think one of the things I heard from that is process, right? Process precedes a lot of the technology and make sure that you've got the right steps and it goes back to your systems thinking. I got one more question. So think of your most successful partner, maybe not the biggest, maybe not the smallest, but the one that's showing the capability to do the things that you want them to do on your marketing platform or in your plays. What's different about them? And any one of you can answer.
I think it's simple, but they're engaged daily. I mean, so they are in the platform daily and we're in there with them. So, I mean, those are our most successful partners. They understand the assets they're looking for. They know the type of customers they want to go after. They provide us with feedback when things aren't working. And then we try to create content for them that we know if it's successful for that partner, it'll be successful for our entire partner database. So, you know, we are big proponents in our sort of space that we try to create content as fast as possible. So it may not be 100% correct every single time, but we try to create content that is good and not perfect. We try to get it out in the field and then iterate on it with feedback from partners and our sales team. That has been the most successful thing for us. And our partners have appreciated that because they, you know how this is, like they come to you the night before, I got this opportunity tomorrow. What do you have for me? If you can be responsive to that need, they are, you know, that's like, you lured them in. They're now a proponent of what you do. They're out there selling it to other partners. You know, we've got partners that'll get on the phone with us, with other partners and say, I use the partner marketing hub. I use their partner resources and I've got XYZ results. Forget it. If that happens, other partners are in 100% because they can hear from us all day. They can hear you spiel all the stats. But if another partner gets on the phone with them and really vindicates or allocates, or I shouldn't say allocates, but advocates for what you're doing, I mean, that's a huge, huge win. So if we can be responsive to their needs in exchange, we can get them to do something for us. That's a win-win.
Excellent. So you got them engaged. Those are the best ones. The ones that are there on a daily basis, using your platform, using your team. Jamie, anything you would add?
No, I think David Coda, the only thing that was kind of in my mind as I was listening to what you were saying was, you know, as part of engagement, kind of the cornerstone of that engagement is they have a plan. They know what they want, right? I mean, you have partners that aren't really clear on what their plan is, right? We just want to make a lot of money with you. We know you're good. We want to make a lot of money with you. But they really don't have a concrete plan that they've thought through. What is realistic? What, you know, with what I have in my kit bag, what you have as a vendor partner in your kit bag together, what can we do? What are the possibilities? So I think getting partners disciplined around having that plan and knowing their core competencies and what they are as a company is really critical. And really every partner should be encouraged to take the time to make sure they validate that they know what their strategic value is. Because I can tell you, I've sat in many, many, many planning meetings with partners and you ask them what their core competency is and it's a conversation around the table and they can't answer it because nobody's ever asked them that. They started because they saw an opportunity and they just got busy and nobody ever went back to who are we? What are we trying to do? So I just think that's really important.
What's your value proposition and all those things? Well, I hope, I saw a lot of you taking notes and, you know, it's not all the time that you get, you know, seasoned experts in the channel to kind of just answer questions about some of the toughest things that we face in channel programs. I want to thank our guests, Jamie, David, and Jason, for joining us today. Thank you very much. And well, I think we're done. Anybody have a question they want to ask the panelists before they sit down? Okay, I knew there was going to at least one. Go ahead.
I think if you go around the room downstairs and there's a lot of movement into intent data and words like surge data, meaning that any organization out there usually are, you know, 10% of them are actually in the market for what you're selling. And if you can narrow in on that 10% and you could wash it with your partner's database that's inside your platform and you could send an email to them saying, hey, listen, you've got a relationship with Acme Corporation and they're surging on, you know, teleconferencing equipment, that's going to drive them back into your environment and hopefully you've got, you know, assets in there that they can then use and actually reach out to that client in a timely manner. It has to be timely. But, you know, I think that's that could be a shining new thing. And it's all about, I think, for everybody who's spending money on their channel and building out these portals, you know, it's about adoption. It's about driving adoption, getting them in there and getting them engaged. So I think that's something that, you know, you could look into.
For us, it's automation, it's AI. We're trying to deliver that more to our partners, but it's also lead gen. So, you know, we're 100% channel company. So we only sell, we don't have any direct at star to star. So, you know, forever our marketing goal was to try to attract and enable more partners. What we've gotten into this year in the last 12 months or so is more customer lead gen. It gets a little tricky though, because we don't have partners that have, you know, specific territories. So how do you decide on who gets those leads and how do you know that the money you're spending, that the partner's following up, because once it goes into the partner's hands, it's their business. It's not mine. Like you said, they don't work for star to star. They work for their own company. So I've tried to bring in some talent to help do some cold calling, to do some lead generation, to do some appointment setting that we're starting with our top partners and sort of working our way down and hoping that we can be an asset for them as well, so they don't have to pay for some of those solutions out of their MDF or their co-op funds. It's just, you have to work through the challenges there and you have to be very cognizant that what works for one partner and how you find a customer may not work for the next partner. And you have to really understand the partner's sales pitch because every partner is a little different. And so it can become expensive if you want to try to do this for 80,000 partners. I don't think that's possible. So good luck. But, you know, for us, when we have 500, 600 active partners, we can be a little bit more agile with that tactic. So for us, that's kind of the next iteration on our dashboard or sort of where we're going.
Yeah. So what we see is just like us, right? We don't need more or want more. We want smarter, right? We are all overworked. I see some very tired looking folks out here and we're all overworked, right? So we absolutely need to be smarter. And our partners are just like our clients. Everybody's going through digital transformation for a reason. We don't know how to harness the data that is out there and available to us about our clients, about ourselves. So, you know, kind of playing on both Cameron and David's points, we have to give our partners a way to harness that data, to you know, harvest it, cultivate it, and then we have to give them the tools to make sense of it. So a lot of you out there in the marketing automation realm with the making sense is absolutely you know, the next thing that we have to do so that we can be smarter in what we're doing and not work harder because we're out of hours in a day.
Good, good. Hey, how about one more round of applause for our panelists? Thank you so much, guys, for sharing all your wisdom. And thank you.